This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next month marks the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Two Japanese cities were destroyed, and the world was introduced to the threat of nuclear weapons. In the new book, Hiroshima in America, Robert J. Lifton writes about how Americans were affected by using the bomb. Lifton is a psychologist who studies the impact of mass trauma on individuals. He won a 1969 National Book Award for his study of Hiroshima survivors. He's also written about Nazi doctors, cult groups, and the psychological impact of living in a world that can be destroyed by nuclear weapons. In his new book, Lifton investigates Americans' profound feelings of conflict and uneasiness about dropping the bomb, and he examines what he calls the official narrative that was created to defend and justify our use of the bomb.
The myth is, which is the official American narrative of Hiroshima, that we dropped the bomb reluctantly after great reflection, only in order to save lives and end the war, and that therefore it was a good and necessary thing, and that we should not in any way trouble ourselves over it.
This was a world war, so, I mean, in one way you could say, of course you're going to use the most effective weapon possible. What's different about using an atomic weapon?
Well, the likelihood was that we were going to use it. That's why we call it an atrocity-producing situation, where the average person, in this case the average president, stepping into that situation, as Truman did on April 12th in 1945, would be likely to make a decision to use the weapon. But there still was a possibility of a different decision. There was still the possibility of human agency, but the structure and the psychology of the situation created the likelihood of its use. And really, one must focus on that in order to prevent that kind of structure and that set of psychological forces from prevailing again.
You trace the beginning of the official version of the story of the atom bomb and why we dropped it on Hiroshima to a press release after the bomb was dropped. Can you read an excerpt of that press release for us, which you reprint in your book, Hiroshima in America?
Probably the most important part of the press release is the first sentence, which reads, 16 hours ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima, an important Japanese army base. And then it goes on to say that bomb had more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It goes on to say the Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid many-fold, and the end is not yet. Only in the third paragraph does it say it is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its powers has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East.
What is so significant about the first sentence that you read about Hiroshima being an important military base?
Well, what's significant about that first sentence is that it's a partial truth, and that is all, and that really matters, because it's true there was a Japanese military base in Hiroshima. It was a staging area for Southeast Asia and an important one, but there was also a city of 300,000 people, and the bomb was aimed at the center of the city. It was targeted on civilians, and it was meant to destroy the city. But the press release presented it as a strictly military action, and it blamed more or less the Japanese for this particular event. Now, again, the Japanese bear some blame because they did initiate the war, but it's a way of exonerating America and completely militarize what was really an attack on a whole city.
Robert J. Lifton is my guest, co-author of the new book, Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial. You say that the government restricted the press's ability to tell the story. How?
Well, the government was very intent upon suppressing images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, especially visual images, and there were very concrete ways in which they did that, especially during the occupation years. For one thing, there were vast filmings taken of atomic bomb effects in Hiroshima and Nagasaki almost immediately after, and then in the first weeks and months. Some were taken by Japanese film crews, and some were taken by American film crews. These were all collected by occupation authorities, and they were simply hidden away in military archives, not to be seen until literally decades later. And there was constantly a policy of ostensibly not wanting to arouse the Japanese, or for the Japanese to become aroused, about the atomic bombings. And that was the rationale for not permitting images to come through. And there were also negations or minimizations of the radiation effects. And above all, there was a resistance to making visible images of what those weapons did to human beings, the really grotesque human effects, so that insofar as Americans got any images of Hiroshima, they tended to be very general, large-scale pictures of destruction of the city.
You say that the myth of Hiroshima, the way that the story has been put forward and perpetrated, is that we reluctantly dropped the atom bomb only because it was necessary to end the war and prevent further carnage, so that we saved lives by dropping the bomb. What evidence do you have that that's just a myth?
Well, I would put it this way. I think that a decision like that is not made for any single reason. We don't operate psychologically with a simple rational cause and effect. We form all kinds of images in our mind, and it becomes a whole constellation or collage of influences. And from that constellation, we act or make a decision. And that's the way I believe that President Truman made his decision.
Do you have information that leads you to believe that we could have had a peace with Japan, that Japan would have surrendered had it not been for the atom bombs?
There's a lot of evidence of a very good possibility that Japan would have surrendered if an effort at negotiation was initiated by us or responded to by us with the condition that the emperor be maintained. That isn't just an impression that I have or that such leading historians as Barton Bernstein and Martin Sherwin and Gar Alpovich have, many others as well. Almost any historian who studies these materials comes to that sense of it being at least a very good possibility. And it was stated so among Truman's advisors. For instance, Joseph Grew, who was acting Secretary of State during part of that period and who knew Japan well, strongly advocated that we look into precisely that kind of negotiation, because he thought that maintaining the emperor was the only condition that the Japanese were holding to. And by not doing that, we strengthened the hand of the more fanatical Japanese who didn't want to surrender under any conditions. And that position won over John McCloy, who was one of Stimson's closest advisors, and also presented it to President Truman. So at the very top of Truman's advisory group, there was that advocacy and that position. Ironically, one of the things that held them back was waiting for the atomic bomb to be finished and to be ready.
Robert J. Lifton is my guest. He's co-author of the new book, Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert J. Lifton, co-author of the new book, Hiroshima in America. Just to get back to the basic premise of your book, you say that since we dropped the bombs on Japan, we've perpetrated this myth that the bombs were dropped reluctantly, only after great reflection, to save lives and end the war. You look at another option that could have been taken in Japan with the atom bombs, and that is the option of using one bomb as a demonstration bomb, dropping it in a unpopulated or relatively unpopulated area and saying to the Japanese, see that bomb? We're going to use it in a populated area if you don't surrender now. Was that option considered, and why wasn't it taken?
The option of a demonstration on an unpopulated area was considered. And there was a scientific subcommittee led by J. Robert Oppenheimer that looked into it. But the requirements of the subcommittee, the deliberations of that subcommittee, were very narrowly defined, only to look at the technical feasibility of such a demonstration. And Oppenheimer's group came back with a report saying they couldn't guarantee that any such demonstration would be effective, or that it wouldn't go wrong, or that something wouldn't happen. So they recommended against any such demonstration, or at least could not support any such demonstration.
Well, they're afraid that the bomb wouldn't work. After all, it had only been tried once.
They were afraid either it wouldn't work, or the plane carrying it might be shot down, or American prisoners of war might be put in that place, all such things. What is sad is that those were the options that most Americans thought we had as one looked back at it, or that were put forward at the time. But the real options were not so much demonstration versus use on a Japanese population as was the possibility of active negotiation for a negotiated surrender, as opposed to some use of added power, such as the bomb or an invasion.
Why do you think a second weapon was used at Nagasaki?
Well, a second weapon was really part of the first order. There was the Nagasaki bomb, or the second city, whichever was decided upon, was in that first order, which was to use available atomic bombs, or atomic bombs as they became available. So one could have used an endless number of bombs according to that order, and that's the way a military order can be given to have that kind of momentum still in the midst of a bloody war. However, there could have been an order to stop, to interfere, and prevent the use of that second bomb. It was not given, and sadly, the second bomb was completed and dropped so quickly that most observers now feel that the Japanese hardly had sufficient time to consider a surrender in between the use of those weapons. There was some impulse to use that second bomb because there was also curiosity about what it could do. It was a different kind of bomb from the uranium bomb used on Hiroshima. It was a plutonium bomb of a different kind and of one that was considered to be highly important for the military future. And that could well have been a factor in carrying out the use of that second bomb or not interrupting that momentum of its use.
President Truman is considered the buck stops here president, a president who was very decisive, who felt that the use of the bombs in Japan were justified and necessary to end World War II and save American lives. He, I think, has said that he never lost any sleep over the decision.
President Truman made many such statements, that he never lost any sleep, that he made a clear-cut decision, but he made those statements in a very agitated way. He spent 25 years of the remainder of his life, after having made that decision, constantly defending it. And he said very different things. He sometimes said it was just like an artillery weapon. When you have it, you use it. At other times, he said it was an awesome weapon that should never be used because it kills women and children indiscriminately. He had those dual feelings about the weapon. But you have to weigh all of these elements as you come to some kind of psychological profile of this man who was inherently decent and struggling to carry through his responsibility as a wartime president as well as he could. He was afraid not to make a decision to use the weapon. It was wartime. It was a bloody war. Americans were enraged at the Japanese. Would they have excused him if he didn't use that weapon? As Burns said, his Secretary of State, he might be crucified by the American people and the victim of an overwhelming congressional investigation if the weapon hadn't been used, an investigation of what had happened to that $2 billion used on that project, a really unprecedented sum at that time. So ironically, one can use a weapon like that because one is afraid not to use it.
You describe Truman as experiencing a, quote, atrocity-producing situation. That's an expression you coined. What does it mean?
An atrocity-producing situation simply means a situation that's so constructed and has such psychological currents so strongly prevalent that the average person walking into it, let's say the average American president in this case walking into it, is likely to make a decision in favor of an atrocity or join in some degree with an atrocity. I came to that idea when thinking about the situation of young men in Vietnam, very decent young American men who had never been prone to violence in any particular way or to harming people in any particular way, but when they arrived at a place like My Lai or other places in Vietnam, could plunge into atrocities because of the psychological currents at hand. That was what I meant by an atrocity-producing situation as Truman entered into it. And contributing to that atrocity-producing situation was the enormous momentum of the bomb project, the tremendous focus on it. And it's ironic in the extreme because it was a great achievement scientifically to make that bomb, and the scientists working on the project really felt that they were doing something that would win the war. That's what they were told. So that all of this was enormous momentum, along with certain advice Truman was getting from his advisors, such as Stimson and others, and particularly Leslie Groves, who was a powerful force in this process, so that it would have taken an act of great courage and statesmanship to have not used the weapon. And that's why there's much speculation on whether President Roosevelt might have taken that second course and not used the weapon.
Getting back to what you describe as the myth that we've been told and that we've perpetrated about our use of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. See, the myth says that we reluctantly, after great reflection, drop the bombs. You also say that Truman's style, the buck stops here style, was a style that really discouraged great reflection.
That's right. It's impossible to undergo great reflection when you're impelled toward quick and immediate decision, often before all of the elements of the problem are clear. That makes it very hard for even one's advisors to lay out all of the considerations that one should look at in making such a decision. There wasn't a lot of reflection about using the weapon. There was intermittent thought and some discussion of the direction of negotiation about the emperor. But there was an obsession very early, even before the bomb appeared, before it was completed, with that weapon. And everybody was waiting for the weapon, so much so that some historians have made, I think, a convincing argument that the bomb probably delayed the end of the war and cost American and Japanese lives rather than having saved them, because there was some inclination toward negotiating with the Japanese, and Truman said that might be a good idea. But then when it was referred to his advisor, Stimson would say, well, the timing isn't right. And the timing isn't right meant that one had to wait for the bomb to appear before any such negotiation. And in that way, there were delays about ending the war that were based on waiting for the bomb and the existence of the bomb. It really shows the danger of creating an object like this and how much it can affect those who create it and contemplate its use.
Your first book on Hiroshima was published in the early 60s. It was Interviews with Hiroshima Survivors. What were some of the themes that emerged in your mind after talking to survivors of the bomb?
If one survived, was fortunate, or some said had the misfortune of surviving, one experienced a lifelong immersion in death. That is, in several stages, first the sea of death around them, at the time the bomb was dropped, and then shortly after, within days or weeks or months, the grotesque appearance of symptoms of acute irradiation, including bleeding from all the major bodily orifices and debilitation and weakness and death very often. And then, not months but years and decades later, the experience of delayed radiation effects in the form of increased incidence of various forms of leukemia and then many of the common forms of cancer. And those returns are still not entirely in because the delayed effects can be after 50 or more years, as we're finding out, and these can be transmitted to subsequent generations. All this leading to the identity of the survivor, hibakusha, as the Japanese call it, which means explosion-affected person or persons, which is an identity very close to death, or identity of the dead, as I called it, even though now many survivors have since renewed their lives and have sought to work and have families, but can never relieve themselves of those dreadful images and the fear that the effects of the bomb will somehow continue.
When was the last time you were in Hiroshima?
I was in Hiroshima about 3 years ago. And when I was there and talked to people there, somebody who followed these effects very closely said, you know, it looks as though the second generation is okay, but we don't know about the third generation. So that the fear is endless.
Do atom bomb survivors in Hiroshima have a kind of special place in the culture of that city?
Atomic bomb survivors are at the heart of the city of Hiroshima and what it stands for. Of course, they become an increasing minority over the decades and an aging population. Nevertheless, they have been a very powerful influence. They have told their stories again and again, and they have told them not just in Hiroshima, but all throughout the world. And the truth about the atomic bombings begins with their stories. They are the survivor witnesses, and then somebody like me and others become witnessing outsiders or witnessing professionals who bear witness by some form of dialogue with the original witnesses, the survivors. But it's the words and experiences of the survivors that are at the heart of the matter.
What kind of commemoration do you think is appropriate for America on the 50th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
The appropriate commemoration for America is to confront everything that happened. That includes Japanese atrocities, including Pearl Harbor, and atrocities in China and South Asia and in World War II. It includes the American sense of a crusade against evil in World War II and brave military conduct on the part of Americans and the losses and sacrifices that American servicemen made. It includes, should include, the actual bombings, the saturation bombings in Europe and in Japan, and then the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the new information from the 70s and after about all of the factors that went into those bombings and the historical disputes about them, all sides of it, and then all of the effects in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, what these weapons do and did to human beings, and their effect upon post-war atomic bomb and nuclear weapons policies and the Cold War. All of this should be looked at, and should be looked at straight and candidly. At the same time, I would ask that Japan do the same thing, and I've said that in Japan on a recent trip and will say it again. So it has to be in a spirit of universality, or what I call species mentality, looking at all of humankind, that we confront Hiroshima, the Japanese confront their atrocities, and we advocate a policy in which countries do their utmost to look at their history, and especially at the more unsavory dimensions of their own history.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Robert J. Lifton is the co-author with Greg Mitchell of Hiroshima in America. Lifton will be in Hiroshima on the 50th anniversary of the bombing, participating in an international symposium. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.